I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, I'll be speaking with C. Derek Varn. Full disclosure, I work with Derek on a podcast through Zero Books entitled Alternatives. Derek is perhaps best known for his political commentary through the Symptomatic Commentary blog and the Symptomatic Redness podcast. But today he'll be speaking with me about his recently released collection of poetry, Apocalyptics, published by Unlikely Books. In our discussion, we cover a great deal of ground, and we make, of course, many digressions, as those who listen to Alternatives should expect from the two of us. Among the topics we cover are Derek's poetic influences, including Philip Larkin and Ezra Pound, Derek's memories of September 11th, 2001 and the terrorist attacks of that day, the religious themes found within Apocalyptics, the nature of trauma, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy my discussion with C. Derek Varn. To segue into the interview, I have a track from the Witch House Project, Black Sailing, entitled Wave Life.
I never see. seen a man so broken up, ripped apart, barred apart.
Welcome to Parallax Views, see Derek Varn.
Hello.
So I wanted to have you on because I've enjoyed your poetry, and you just came out with a new book of poetry called Apocalyptics. A lot of people, I think, have focused on your political writing, but you know, you consider yourself a poet first and foremost.
Yeah. I mean, the funny thing about my political writing is I actually don't do a lot of it. Which is kind of funny. I think I've written 5 political articles in 6 or 7 years. And what I'm more known for, I mean, people think of me as a political writer, but what I actually do more is cultivate other political writers. And I do that at Zero Books, obviously, but I also do it. I did it at, a couple of different magazines. Net magazines, the North Star, Disloyal Opposition to Modernity. And I guess I'm also kind of famous for being a contentious shit poster. So, although I gotta be honest with you, getting back into poetry and doing this has been very refreshing for my mental health because it gets me away from toxic internet culture, which is holy crap toxic lately.
I think we've both seen that.
Yeah, well, you know, what is it I said to you the other day? Your wall's a cesspool and my wall's a cesspool. All walls are a cesspool.
Indeed.
Anyway, so yeah. But yeah, I'm actually trained as a, you know, I've trained in a couple of different things, but I have an MFA in poetry, and it's by far the vast amount of writing that I do is either poetry itself or about poetry. And a side gig that I don't really get paid for in relation to poetry as I run a used to be a podcast, although the podcast hasn't been releasing in a couple of, I can't think, years at this point. I used to do a podcast and magazine on art, and I still do the magazine part called Former People, and it's mostly poetry and flash fiction. So
do you feel like your poetry, I know a lot of it's very personal, and you sort of alluded to it being maybe therapeutic in a way?
Oh, Lord. That's actually, you know, that's a harsh. I'm going to say some things that are going to seem elusive, but my poetry actually is probably less personal than people think. A lot of it has been recently, but it's not actually a lot of what's in this book. And I am highly distrustful of straight up clean confessional personal poetry. So a lot of the therapeutic elements of the poems, I would say, are kind of an act. weirdly. I mean, like, you can't process trauma and stuff that way, and in a kind of direct and thought out way. This book, Apocalyptix, is about processing trauma and about the way that can be misallocated into politics, misallocated into religious fervor, misallocated into sex addiction. But I would also say there's a strong, theoretically, in a lot of my poetry, there's actually a strong sense of poetry as resisting therapy and as resisting the ability to conclude and draw any clear conclusions about how to live your life. And that is because, you know, I have a critique of therapeutic approaches to psychology, period. I'm not saying that therapy is bad. I'm not one of these anti-psychiatry, anti-psychology people, but I do sort of think a lot of therapy is pseudo-resolution. Having attempted psychoanalysis at one point in my life, early on to deal with depression, I found that, like, I talked a whole lot and would try to talk myself into kind of fake conclusions for problems. And I actually think, you know, as personal advice, that if you were going to go through a therapeutic regimen, something like cognitive behavioral therapy or dialectical behavioral therapy would be more useful. And frankly, I don't know that my poetry has anything to do with that, which is probably not the answer you were expecting to get.
One of the interesting things about Apocalyptix is, I guess, you wrote the poems, I think, at a very specific point in time. They deal with I think they were written during the Bush era, right? Or about that time period.
Yeah, so here's the thing about this book. Some of the poems in this book were written as early as 1999. I mean, like, when I was 19 years old. And some of the poems in this book were written as late as 2015. But the first full draft of the book was completed in 2006. All right, and I started on it as a book and not just as a collective of poems in 2004. So there's a whole lot of Bush era stuff in it. And when I went back to I've rewritten this book a bunch of times. And when I said when you rewrite a collection of poetry, some of it's revising the poem, some of it's just curating the poems. So the poems feed into each other better and say a lot about the same thing. So even poems that are written later are still about the same time period because they inform each other. So, yeah, this is very much a Bush era book. And you may know this about the cover. A lot of people love the cover. But the original cover that I picked by the artist Adrian Kenyon, I picked a series of – he did the series of apocalyptic collages. And I, you know, I wrote him and I was like, I would love to use any of these for the cover. Actually, I didn't write him. My publisher did. My publisher presented him as one of the several options. And I said, I asked him to write him. And the one I most wanted and the one we actually settled on was the one you see, except originally the key figures in it were George Bush and Osama bin Laden. Which is much more relevant to the book. But since we are now, you know, a good 8 years beyond the Bush years, 9 years beyond the Bush years, really, and so you know, we have a very short cultural memory in some ways, we decided that, well, my publisher decided that maybe it was a good idea to go with with an updated version that was made specifically for the book with the key figures turned into Kim Jong-il and Trump. Now, I wrote a letter to my publisher about this, and I was of two minds. On one side, I think it was interesting because I do think there's a lot of ways, in which the poems in this book, even though they're about 10 to 15, you know, 10, between 10, 15 and 5 years ago, would be super relevant, like now, in ways they wouldn't have been relevant in 2015. But there are other ways in which, if you read this and think this is about, if you think this is about like Trump's America, you're profoundly misreading the book. And that presents a particular problem, you know, for marketing and keeping something like this relevant. I mean, but, and part of the issue with poetry is poetry collections actually do tend to be written over a long period of time. I mean, some people can crank out tons of the poems, like I can. But a collection that's thematically coherent and not just a bunch of random poems together usually has to be, you know, scoped and can take between, you know, 1 and 4 years to really get to where it needs to be. And then another, because poetry's not as lucrative a publishing market, as in not at all, it can take another 2 to 5 years to get the book out. Once you get a book out, it's a lot easier, but your first books usually take a while. So it's that there's often books. I was reading Nikki Finney's Twist, Head, and Spit, which is another book that came out, I think, in 2013, and it was clearly about the same time period I'm writing about, but it was released, like, you know, in the second term of the Obama administration. So that happens in poetry, I think, more than it happens in prose, because it takes so long to get this stuff done and out.
So you said some of these poems even go back to, like, the time when you were 19. You know, it's obvious you've been into poetry for a long time. How did you get into poetry and the poetry scene?
Oh, man, I started writing poetry for zines in the early, mid-90s as a teenager. And the first publication that really published me that you could still find some of the work would be actually Unlikely Stories, which is, you know, the magazine that over the 20 years that I've been working has also been turning itself into a more and more, you know, serious magazine. It kind of started off as a net zine in the late 90s when those were barely a thing. And they did like very small, you know, like just a step above Xerox level chapbooks, you know, and they have as micropress, you know, it's an interesting time for the publishing industry, right? Because micro presses are easier to run now than they were in the past. But at the same time, there's the market's glutted, and the margin of profit for big publishers has dropped dramatically. So we're in a particular time where a small press, I mean, you know, Unlikely Stories is basically four people, and Unlikely Press is basically Jonathan Pynton, you know. But he's been running this, so he published me, and that's how I kind of got into this scene. But I started writing poetry for like punk magazines, you know, like punk goth poetry, probably when I was 15 years old. You know, it was one of those things that was nerdy, but it was nerdy within the realm of like something that you could do in the 90s and, you know, write this terrible teenage stuff and get it published in zines done by other teenagers. And that's how I first got into it. I really started getting into literary magazine publishing actually in late high school. I thought I was going to be a journalist, you know, in the late 90s before the net screwed all that up. And in fact, I really thought I was going to be a science writer, to be honest. I thought my goal was to like write anthropology articles for like Scientific American and National Geographic. So I did all this newspaper volunteer work. And on the side, since we used the same, I used the same like high end at the time, kind of expensive publication software for the newspaper stuff to do literary magazine stuff. And that's how I got into it. And so I did my high school literary magazine for 3 years. Then I was a major part of the college literary magazine. And while I was doing that, as a sort of like stress relief, I'd done some theater and stuff in college. But as a, you know, I was studying anthropology, philosophy on one side, and then English literature, like old school on the other. Because when I first entered, I wanted to study journalism to be a science writer, but I found the journalism program to be mind-numbingly obvious, which sounds insulting, but I didn't learn much from it. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna get just a traditional English degree, and also I realized that if I did the traditional English degree, with the philosophy/anthropology, I could easily pivot into law if this whole writing thing didn't work out. Well, long story short, none of it worked out because I kept on picking fields that were collapsing as I was looking at going into them. But I was doing poetry this whole time as part of just that passion project. And also it was relevant tangentially to what I was studying. Originally, you know, when I was first publishing was like, I would say sort of J.G. Ballard, high weirdness, vaguely magical realist short stories. But I realized pretty quickly that the genre market was flooded and that I was a little bit too obtuse for it and a little bit too dense a writer. I was just given to like really dense writing. I'm also dyslexic and aphasic, so to make that matters worse, the writing process for prose was just way longer for me to properly edit and keep the sort of the word by word level up enough. And I moved away from it because it was just I wasn't getting as much out of it as the poetry over time. Although I never set out to be just like a professional poet, because that seems like a bad idea, really.
Right. Well, I was going to say, I know you said your writing can be very dense at times. I was going to ask, since I've talked to you about it before, you said you were influenced by another poet who could be very dense, Ezra Pound. Would you want to talk about that influence, or?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I feel like I'm one of these people who has to go out and defend Ezra Pound, although he's actually kind of come slightly back into vogue, even though his politics are way more problematic than they were when I first studied him. I mean, I knew he had this vague overlap with fascism, but one of the things I got from studying the cantos is, like, if you start understanding what he's saying, wow. You know, he was trying to put a developed and kind of weird archaic economic system into verse. What I got from Pound was a willingness to pull from other cultures, to use modern talk to be appropriative, but not to claim like any ownership or erasure of those cultures. So you just sort of present stuff from a variety of origins into a text. And the other thing I got from Pound is that if you have good enough images, people will tolerate really, really, really hard to get allusions and still think you're kind of accessible. So what you have to kind of do, and I really got this a lot out of Pound and Wallace Stevens, you know, a lot of these high modernist authors, is be dense, but make sure that the music of the poetry is accessible enough that people can get a beat from it so that they can appreciate it musically, and then that the images are arresting enough that the images stay in their head. And if you do that, if you pay attention to the images and the sound before you pay attention to the meaning, really, you can get away with writing poems about all kinds of hyper complicated, obscure stuff, and people will still find you moderately accessible, because you have given them something they can immediately see and grasp onto. And this doesn't show up so much in this book, but in later books I learned also a few lines that are funny also usually buys you a whole lot of charity.
Right, right. And, you know, another poet, and I don't know if he influenced you, but I could see shades of his style a bit in Apocalyptics at times, is Philip Larkin.
Oh yeah. Philip Larkin has a strong influence on me. You know, one of the things about Larkin that I've always liked, Larkin has this ability to like flirt with sentimentality, but do so in a way that is so utterly unsentimental that the contrast between the two actually says something. So if you think about the, the famous Erdel Tun poem, for example, right? People question with life is what is left of us is love, except that the point of the poem that probably isn't what is actually left of us. And that probably wasn't true in the case of the tomb. And so what I got from Larkin is a willingness to kind of subsist into completely disparate emotional registers and to like give people enough sentimentality that they can grasp onto it, but also to yank it out from under them in the next line or in a previous line. Another poet who does this, that people don't realize he does this if they're not reading closely, is Robert Frost. The famous example of this is the Road Not Taken, which the entire poem is mocking the conclusion, and all anyone ever remembers is the conclusion.
Moving on from those influences, how did you develop your own unique voice going from those days as, sort of the punk goth teenager who was kind of angsty with stuff to the poet you've become now? Sorry if that's like an in-depth question.
Well, no, it is an in-depth question. And it's fine. It's one of those questions that seems like it should be simple to answer, and it's really, really not. The one thing I could say is I had to learn to take other people into account when I wrote poetry, and then I also had to learn to not do that, which is a crazy sort of thing. So I went through an MFA, and one of the things I got from my MFA is a lot of MFA poems can read like poems by committee. Because you're going through a workshop, you're getting like 10 people who are training to be this thing, giving you advice. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. But the thing is, even if they come from different styles, or which honestly they usually don't. Usually there's kind of a house style to who's accepted into a program based on who teaches in it. But even if there's not, you can often get a kind of poetics that is very in line with the times, because your reading audience is immediately you. I mean, people who are like you, who have your concerns, who are doing what you do. All right. And so, there was this trend when I was in the MFA to write very imagey, very narrative poems on one end. And then from like the Iowa school and then the language poet schools, which were kind of fading in the time I entered my MFA, but they were still around. I mean, Iowa's obviously still around, but to kind of go deep image, tons of allusions, tons of references, metatextuality, and to be opaque, or in the case of language poetry, to not even care if there was any narrative or cognitive meaning at all, and to go pure sound. And I was attracted to all those things. I really thought that avant-garde poetry had kind of become too formalist and too alienated. So I started getting into this sort of hybrid movement where you would take sort of high modernist or postmodern or whatever you want to call it, various different like techniques that you use to make poetry more alien and more experimental, and then to kind of ground it in images or narrative or more traditional voice or even more traditional forms. In a way that sort of paired the two. And the other thing that really helped is the fact that my frame of reference, both in reading and in my life, is really broad. In my life, it's because I've lived in about 5 countries at this point and been to about 20. And I'm not saying that everyone can do that or should. We're not all independently wealthy. I'm not either. How I did it was my job. And by reading extensively in as a diverse array as you can. So when I was first in, I mean, a MFA program, I was taking this highfalutin sort of, we're artists, we only do high-end art, and I would read like Dahlke Archive and University of Iowa and, exclusively like dense avant-garde stuff. And I like some of the beat poets, but that was a dirty secret. And, and stuff like that. And then, I don't know, sometime around 2003, 2004, right before I got into my MFA, I just was like, you know what? I enjoy all of this. Like, I like Billy Collins, for people to know the way, poet laureate of the United States, like 10 years ago, who's really kind of a comic poet. I like Kay Ryan. I like Robert Frost, even. I like 18th century romantic poetry. You know, like, I don't have to pick an allegiance to just one of these things. So I started cultivating a voice that was very much rooted in me, but also would take elements from things that were completely and totally apart. So I will reference, you know, in a poem like this, you might see me reference Wittgenstein, Giacomo Leopardi, and yet also reference punk rock, klezmer music, jazz, parties, you know, parties over Y2K, that sort of thing. And so an original voice for me is about, one, keeping enough of yourself in a narrative voice, unless you're writing a persona poem, that there's some of your personality in it. I would say some, because a lot of it's exaggerated, and some of the stuff that people assume are autobiographical in these poems aren't, and some stuff that is autobiographical people wouldn't assume. And really what you're doing as an author, as a person, is curating your inputs, and that's in what you read and what you watch on television and what you do in your daily life. And you have to pull from all of that. And so, like, asking, like, clearly, like, how do you develop your own poetic voice? And, you know, in a way, it's just, one, be willing to sound like yourself. Two, realize that other people are going to influence you, and how you best handle that is to curate what you intake. So read widely, read stuff that you actually like, and don't let one, like, aesthetic commitment stop you from reading or enjoying something. You know, with movies, for example, there's no reason to see a movie you don't like, and there's no reason to only eat, you know, to only eat junk food like Marvel movies. But if you sincerely like Marvel movies, then it's not going to harm you to watch one, as long as you're still watching other things that you like that are also, you know, of caliber and note. And that's, you know, how I tell people to kind of read and curate what they take in when they're training to be a writer, because so much of that comes from what you expose yourself to.
You don't want to, like, limit yourself to just one way of thinking about things. You want to explore all kinds of different areas.
Yeah, don't do to yourself aesthetically what people do to themselves politically on Facebook.
I like that.
You know, and honestly, I tend to, like, advise against schools of thought in literature for that reason, too. Although, you know, poetic schools and stuff have really sort of faded away. Part of that's the program era, and there's good and bad things to that. I mean, you know, it's not even a secret anymore that the MFA was partly encouraged by the precursors and the early CIA as a way to, you know, get all these dissident artists in a safe place like a university. But I'd also say, like one of the good things about that, and one of the good things about the internet, is that these regional schools of thought, like the Beats or the New York Poets or whatever, are no longer as limiting, because your social circle can be a lot broader. And your aesthetic circle is theoretically unlimited. So you don't just have to have access to the small press in your city to learn about certain kinds of poetry and stuff anymore. And we forget that in prior to the 70s, really, a lot of the poetic schools that developed in Europe and North America were kind of from the fact that, like, they were run by small presses. The small presses could really only produce on a regional output. Those were the people you also went drinking with. And there wasn't any other real form a way for you to get exposure, and so you would develop a school out of, like, your friends and buddies who also had access to a press that was also regionally specific. And we don't live in that world anymore. So in another way, you know, part of that's sad, part of that's tragic, but part of that makes those, like, that limiting of yourself a lot less necessary.
So one of the other sections of the book, the second section of the book, is named Like History, Like Pasolini. Since we were talking a little bit about, you know, being influenced by film and poetry, Pasolini did both of those, so.
Yep. Yeah, it was Like History, Like a Pasolini film. And yeah, although people think I'm referring to Salo and I'm not, so.
It's weird how people don't seem to like, I feel like people that, when you mention Pasolini, they only know Salo.
Yeah, because it's shocking. It's shocking. And I don't even know that they get Salo. No, they don't know the Decameron. They don't know the Gospel According to St. Matthew. You know, they don't know his poetry. I love Pasolini. I like his poetry a whole lot. I, you know, was trying to teach myself Italian at one point when I was in Korea before I met my wife to kind of, honestly, to hit on an Italian professor that I worked with and also to read Pasolini in the original. I never really got good at it. So the fascinating thing about all of that to me in with Pasolini is you know, all about showing a variety of life in a sort of raw way. If you see the Decameron, it's a romantic. If you see Salo, it's anti-romantic. But there's a sort of willingness to let, you know, things be what they are and be beyond even what they are in Pasolini that I find quite interesting. And so this book has an overall religious theme, you get in the title. And as I was interviewed recently by Danny Anderson of the Sectarian Review, which is on the Christian Humanist Network, and he was fascinated by the fact that he realized in talking to me that I told, from the Christian's perspective, the book tells the story of creation backwards. And that I kind of got that idea from Pasolini and, although he doesn't do that in the movie, but Pasolini's, Gospel According to St. Matthew, where he tells the story of Jesus and he tells it beautifully in a way that Christians can appreciate, but he's writing it for communists. So he's right. using Christian imagery and the story of Jesus to make a point that Christians could feel respected by and enjoy, but also does something completely different, isn't as concerned with the theology, and tries to embody it in the real world and see what the, you know, if you cut the theological parts of it off, what would it mean? And I literally think that's what I was trying to do in this book with the apocalyptic imagery and the sexuality, which is also something that shows up in Pasolini. And in the early Pasolini films, the sexuality is like innocent and it's kind of sexy. And then in the later Pasolini film, which is Salo, it makes you like not, you know, it's like not wanting, if you've ever watched Salo, it's a boner killer.
Yeah.
Like for months, not for an evening. You're just like, oh God, human sexuality is so vile. And I actually, again, not just with reversing like the religious imagery. So I start off with the apocalypse and we end on like Adam and Eve imagery. Although people, if you're not reading very closely, you won't see that. I also start off with the sort of Saulian, like sex is bad and most of the people are sex addicted and all that. Partly because at the time I was making a comment about how many people were experimenting with sex because the AIDS scare was just ending. You know, the late 80s, most of the 90s AIDS scare was ending and people were experimenting with sex again. And you saw stuff like the ethical slut and polyamory and stuff come back into the regular vocabulary. And one of the things I don't think has been pointed out most a lot about that is, you know, sex positive feminism and sex negative feminism was talked about a lot. But what I haven't heard talked about a lot is that like all those like alternative lifestyles thing partly spread on the internet, which I have heard people say, but also partly spread because the AIDS scare was over. And I haven't heard people talk about that explicitly that much. And the AIDS scare over, a lot of people were experimenting when I was in college with like lots of different kinds of basically like free sex, polyamory, kinky sex, all that kind of stuff. And they were really, really immature with it. And a lot of people got emotionally stunted and damaged and kind of took advantage of people and all that. In ways that it kind of resemble, you know, what college students always do to each other, because you get a bunch of young adults and separate them out and have them spend the time together. You know, probably what's going to happen. But also in ways that I think were very specific to the time, because of this, you know, people were kind of like the trauma of the 80s and 90s made the sexual explorations of the 70s seem interesting again, but it didn't last very long, I don't think. So like by 2007, by the end of the Bush years, you saw a turn against sex positive feminism and all that, pretty clearly.
Yeah, it's interesting now, especially with like all these this whole like Me Too scandal and like the stuff with Corey Feldman and Allison Mack now in Hollywood. There's like a huge backlash.
Yeah, although I mean it's interesting to me too, because no one took Feldman seriously, and I actually sort of assumed what he was saying was true. I don't think sexual experimentation. There's a tendency on the left right now, actually, interestingly enough, not just the puritanical stuff, but just a lot of like far leftists who like, you know, we need to return to normal, you know, serial monogamy and all that. And I don't know that that's realistic either, but I do know that, you know, I think that. I think the idea that we live in a really sexually permissive culture is just not true, and it wasn't true and before, you know, before things like people like Me Too is have a stifling effect on it. I don't think so.
It's interesting. People have been flipping out over the this whole thing with Jordan Peterson talking about enforced monogamy, and he's saying, "Oh, well, I meant we need to culturally, you know, promote monogamy," and I'm like, it seems like that's already still the norm.
Yeah, I mean, here's like polyamorous people are more. You do see it, although there's already a backlash against that. I was seeing someone saying that polyamory is just, you know, secular Mormonism, which I snickered at, living in Utah now. But you know, my Mormon friends won't appreciate that joke. But I also sort of think that that monogamy is the norm, and there's a couple of reasons why it is. I don't want to get into that philosophical discussion here. I my point about the sexuality stuff and about the stuff that in this book, and actually in Pasolini too, although why I read Pasolini backwards, is like a lot of sexual innocence can lead to abandon and excess that is super exploitative. Doesn't have to be that way. But you have to acknowledge that it's real.
Right, right.
And that's, you know, that's true if you're monogamous, or you're polyamorous, if you're gay, straight, LBTYQ plus, I don't even know what all goes in that anymore because I'm getting old. But you know, that's where we are. I also find it interesting, and this I'm gonna come off as an old man, but I find it interesting that sexual identity, which is always a big thing since the 90s, but became a really big thing since I wrote this book. Because I say some things in it that I was thinking, oh, is that going to be considered really problematic now? But it wouldn't have been at the time when I wrote the poem. But sexual identity is way more a part of our culture, but actual sex, young people have less of it. Every study I read says that millennials and Zs are less sexually active than their Gen X and older millennial and boomer counterparts. You know, there is more hookups apparently, but like that's a small part of the population. But it means that people are having less sex, and also it's not committed, which is weird. I do think that might in some way be a result, not so much of like useful and provocuity, but that weird period at the end of the 90s that I grew up through, where we did sort of, when the AIDS scare went away, we did sort of try to go back to the excess of the 70s, but realized quicker than they realized in the 60s and 70s that it didn't really work.
Right, right. It's interesting, like sort of tying some of these threads together. You know, you deal with issues of sexuality, you deal with the backdrop of the war in Iraq, and like I said, you have a poem and a section named after Pasolini. One of the things that's interesting that you mentioned earlier is that you wanted to be a journalist. And actually, Pasolini was, people forget this, he was an excellent investigative journalist. So I want to ask about the influence of journalism on your work and sort of getting at the real.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to do first. I had this really romantic notion about being a journalist. I mean, I'll tell you this crazy story, right? I ended up homeless twice in my life. One time was legit out of money. And then I was also homeless for a very brief time with my mother as a baby. But there was this one time when I was homeless where I didn't have any money then either, but like I kind of deliberately did it to like, I was going to write about gutter punks and see what their life was like. And so I wanted to live with them for a month. But what I realized when I did it is that once you become homeless, it's very hard to be not. So I started off like as an affect tech, lower middle class, not middle class even truly, but lower middle class, 18-year-old just out of high school, trying to be a romantic writer living with these gutter punks who were like doing narcotics all the time. And I ended up sucked into that world in a way that it took me a couple months to get out of. And like it started off as an affectation, and it ended up, you know, with me being part of the subject in a very real way, because it's hard to get a job with an address. And basically what got me out of that was getting a scholarship to go to college and someone finding me. And so, yeah, that informs a lot of this. That informs a lot of who I am politically, too, although it led me to a very right-wing place after a while. I did that shortly after going to the battle for Seattle when I was 18 years old. And I don't think I've ever talked about this, but that experience and the mixture of the battle for Seattle and then going to school and dealing with, like, the post-structuralist sort of liberal left of the late 90s, like, turned me into a conservative for a couple of years. Because it was just such a bad experience.
Yeah, I can get that. That happened with me, too, as you know.
Yeah, so, like drug culture was terrible, and, like, being homeless is really shitty. A lot of things that become, like, you know, finding a place to sleep becomes a legal issue. that reality for me was, it was just interesting, and, like, you know, I mentioned this in one of the poems, actually. I saw someone dying of AIDS during that time period because, you know, they couldn't get treatment. And they were like, crazy. They had all the, you know the leukemia lesions that you get from advanced stage AIDS, right? Like, if depending on what you get with it. And this guy had all the lesions and everything, and he was going nuts. He was just talking to himself in the street. And we found, I think, the week before I finally got found and, you know, cleaned myself up and went to school. But we found him, like dead on the side of the road a couple weeks later.
Wow.
And that was super traumatizing to me. Now, for those who don't, I think maybe you can pick up on this, that want to be the real is interesting. What I got out of doing journalism is it's very hard to write directly about cultural tragedy and trauma in a way that's honest. And so the way I handle it is just not write about it directly. Like, I think about this too. People read my poetry, they would like, oh, you don't write political poetry even though you're a super political person. And I would say, I do write political poetry. I just don't write didactic political poetry. I don't tell you how you're supposed to feel about anything. And also, because of that, like, when 9/11, Y2K, the Iraq War, and all that stuff that comes up, I don't try to write about those directly. I try to write about peripherally dealing with the aftermath of all of that. So, you know, I don't write poems about 9/11 directly, but I write poems in which that is a backdrop to someone having a nervous breakdown or a bunch of people making out on a couch the night after. Oh, I do write about 9/11 directly, but not about, you know, the planes crashing, the terrorist event, or the politics around that. I wrote about what people did that night.
Right, right. In the title poem, actually, Apocalyptics, yeah. is has 9/11 as the backdrop. It's kind of harrowing in ways, that poem.
Yeah, one of the two backdrops is 9/11, and the second backdrop is Y2K and the year 2000 party, which a lot of people thought was going to be the end of the world. And Y2K was a secular version, and there was a lot of like millennialist Christians who really did think the world was going to end that night. And so we start off at a – so the night – I'll tell the point that I read the poem. We haven't actually read a lot of this poetry, so I'll tell the story about behind both events behind the story of that poem, and then I'll read the poem to you. So the night of 9/11, the day after it happened, yeah, I was a junior or senior in college. I was a junior in college, beginning to finish up my degree, and we were in class, and the first plane hit, this is going to sound so crazy and so surreal, but my first thought was, what dumb fuck didn't listen to air traffic control? Seriously, because we didn't know what was going on. And then we turn on the TV, and as we're turning on the TV, I think in about 2 minutes, because we just got out of class. Like I was in a morning anthropology class, I believe. And we turn on, and then the second plane hits. And all of our mouths drop. And then the plane goes down outside of Johnstown. Well, at the time, you live in PA, right?
Right, right. I'm maybe like an hour and a half away from Shanksville.
So you know where Shanksville, Somerset, and Johnstown are?
Yeah.
My ex, who was my girlfriend at the time, was living in Erie, but I thought she'd gone home from Erie back to her hometown of Johnstown. And people don't remember this, but this was the very beginning of cell phones. Most of the landlines and all the cell phones crashed. So we couldn't get through to her. I couldn't call her from Georgia. So I was freaking out. And so, and then another one of my friends, father was a businessman, and he was stuck in Mexico because the border shut down. And people forget, pre-9/11, it was really easy to go back and forth to Mexico and Canada.
Right.
You know, I have family in Canada. I was partly raised there even, and I used to go back and forth across the border without a passport. You can't really do that now. Or maybe you can, but I don't think – it's not easy. Everything shut down, so we didn't know what to do. We were trying – at first we were watching the news, but they showed the towers collapsing on repeat. So you just saw it over and over and over and over and over again. And I was just like, we can't watch this anymore. So we go back to my apartment. There's about 9 of us, and everybody's crying and everybody's upset. So I grab a movie to watch to just take the tension off. It's one that I'd written the night before, and this is such a strange detail. I don't include it in the poem because I don't think people will believe me, but it was that Jeffrey Rush movie about sod.
Okay, yeah, with Jeffrey Rush was in it, and I forget who directed it, but I know the movie, yeah.
Yeah, so, but that was just like, I just rented it from like Blockbusters and like the 2 days before, so I just popped that in, and it got weirdly like hedonistic, like, people just started making out with each other and all the and stuff, and we started drinking. And I wanna say it was kind of orgiastic, but it was not like happy fun. It was like do anything to distract myself from thinking about this any fucking more. And the other time I remember that something like that happening is the year 2000, and so it's only, I actually wrote this poem in 2013, but at the time it's about, I think this is not even, these are like a year and a half apart, right? So it's 1999. year 2000. And we're having this, you know, kind of raucous New Year's party. It's a bunch of 19 to 30-year-olds, you know, drinking and doing New Year's stuff. And it gets just as orgiastic as you think it will. But some of the people actually kind of have breakdowns as midnight approaches because some of them have weirdly internalized this kind of apocalypse conspiracy, like religious apocalypse conspiracy culture. We were in Georgia, so like a lot of people were raised with this. And while none of them, like I wouldn't say any of my friends at this party, they weren't the kind of people who would have been actually been like end times preppers, but they were related to people who were. And so there was two different people that night who kind of had nervous, kind of emotional breakdowns at the party. One is the stripping incident that I talk about, and there's actually another person who's just sort of went semi-catatonic for part of it. And I just remember, you know, in the midst of this revelry, noticing that because these people had internalized this sort of 80s and 90s like Christian apocalyptic culture, and a mixture of relief that it wasn't happening, but fear that it might, but also like this worldview that I kind of reject, but kind of don't, because it's part of who my family is. It is obviously not true, and it was actually traumatic. And for some reason, when I was writing this poem, in hindsight, when I, you know, as a 33-year-old man, at this the age I was when I wrote it, because ironically, even though this poem is about explicitly the time period that these poems were written in the most, it is the one of the poems was written the latest. I was just amazed at the way like this, there was some deep trauma, not just that from the apocalypticism, but also that I think that the apocalypticism was masking. So, you know, that like it was, it was easy, you know, that whole, sorry, I'm being a little manic here because I'm thinking a lot about what I mean, but that whole phrase that Mark Fisher quotes and that Jamerson quotes and that Zizek quotes, I don't know who actually said it, that it's easier to imagine the apocalypse and the end of capitalism.
Right, right. Yeah, I like that.
Well, I also was thinking at the time it was easier to imagine the apocalypse than working out your trauma.
That seems to be true for a lot of people, especially today, so whether liberal or conservative.
Right. And I mean, I do think a lot of politics these days is actually not properly political, that it's therapeutic.
It's terror management theory.
Right. And that's informing the book as well, because it's coming out of the experience of living through that. And I was just the right age to notice what that meant. I mean, you know, I'm 19 to – this all happened between, you know, all this kind of – so if you think about my adulthood, my adult life kind of begins with the Oklahoma City bombing. I'm a little bit, you know, that happens when I'm 16. And so these sort of traumas, that's 16 through the onset of the, what we now call the internet 2.0, or what, you know, people don't even remember it's the 2.0, but that, and that's what shaped me as a person. And I think like I've used that both artistically and even, you know, this relates to what else I do, the politics stuff, to understand the way a lot of people misplace personal identity and trauma regulation and all that into their religion, their politics, and their sexuality in ways that I don't think is good for any part of the equation.
Well, that's what people have often asked me, why I find like conspiracy culture interesting, even though I'm not really, you know, I'm not big on conspiracy theories myself, and it sort of hits on all those. A lot of the conspiracy culture deals with it almost feels like a way of dealing with trauma when people talk about 9/11, JFK, Oklahoma City in this conspiratorial way. It's rather interesting. That apocalypticism again comes up.
Yeah, and you know, there's this other thing where the reason why I use so much religious imagery is I do. God, I'm going to sound like a conservative when I say this, and I don't mean this as I mean this in the way Nietzsche means it. I don't know that the fading of a Christian ethos is good or bad entirely, but I do know that so much of our ways of dealing with things seems to have a Christendom-shaped hole in it in America and Europe. And so a lot of the ideas and a lot of the inversion of religious ideas in this book, which, you know, I would encourage people to go out and read, and I've actually specifically asked Christians to read it because I want to know what they think about it. But where I start off in what seems to be religious assumptions, and then I secularize it, and then I see what the results of that are. And it plays out in various ways. Another poem that's explicitly like that, other than Apocalyptus, is Making Love to the Sound of Televised War, which people assume is about me. It's not. It's actually it's a hybrid of my experience, some other people's experience, and then a lot of – for a very brief period of time in my life, 2001 to 2003, I worked off and on at a military college as either a writing tutor or an adjunct. And I did it again later on. And I worked with a lot of people there, and oh god, that I'm not going to name the school, but people can kind of figure it out if they really look it up. It was I actually taught English at one point in the converted state house of the state government that sided with the Confederacy. Talk about a traumatic, historically laden place, right? So I was teaching English in the, you know, to like cadets there. But a lot of these cadets had like weird when they came back, because they were some of them were trying to become officers before they came, but some of them were coming back and going to school, and you know, and some of them were like maimed and stuff, but they were still dating, but a lot of them had developed like weird kind of complex PTSD that would often manifest in their personal and sexual relationships in ways that were kind of debilitating. And you know, I was friends with some of these guys, and I was also teaching them, which was kind of a weird situation, but like I would get this information from them. And then I was thinking, it's gotta be really weird. Let's say you come back and there's TV news around all the time, right? And it's kind of half reporting on this, but also in the Bush era, we forget this. In the Vietnam era, when they showed stuff from Vietnam, they were showing live footage from an actual war zone, which people really forget. In the American era, the American century era, which is what I actually mean, in the late 90s and the aughts, you would get like flashes of bombs on screen, but you don't really see anything. But if you were the kind of person who was easily triggered by it, and I don't mean that in the current way we use that term, I mean in the stricter sense, triggered by something, it could intrude on you at any time. And also, what could intrude on you, what could cause a traumatic backlapse or whatever, could be things that did not seem like they would invoke trauma. I mean, obvious things are like, you know, fireworks, but there's also non-obvious things like just the mention of the war on the news, are certain smells that you wouldn't even predict, are like where you had to sit in a Wendy's. And this affected their personal and private relationships and their sexual relationships quite a bit. And I remember just, you know, helping some of my students like get help for that. And then, you know, I had close family friends, you know, I would have been 19 when Bush came in the office, and I was 21 when 21, 22, when the Iraq war really started, the second one. And so, you know, I knew a lot of people who fought in that war and came back. And that was, you know, that was the backdrop of a whole lot of what was going on in my life, because I'm also from a southern town. And if you wanted to get a college education and you weren't really smart or, you know, and can get a – and now we did have the Hope Scholarship in Georgia, so it made it a little easier. But if you weren't like a – if you weren't a honor roll to just below student, the other way to get out was to go into the military. Because there wasn't a whole lot of work for you in Central Georgia. So, you know, you probably needed to get out. And the ways to do it were go to college or go to the military. You know, so, and I people know this about me. I'm not working class really. Well, in a very strict sense, I'm working class now, but I'm not like super working class anymore, but I grew up, you know, my stepfather was a mechanic and my mother was a waitress turned nurse. So guess what about 3/4 of my friends did? They went into the military. So that's very much a backdrop to all this.
Well, I wanted to we'll have you read your poems, but I wanted to rewind a bit because a lot of it's very odd. What I like about your poetry is it gets its finger on the pulse of a lot of things culturally, and it goes in so many different directions. And I wanted to go back to the gutterpunk thing real quick.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about a lot of these gutterpunks, because there's gutterpunks where I'm at too, and what's oddly happening now, I don't know, do you know the publication Death to the World?
I knew of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. A lot of these, like, gutterpunk kids end up getting into the whole Orthodox punk scene and converting to, like, hardcore Christianity.
Oh, no, hardcore Orthodoxy, like, Seraphim Rose level style, yeah.
Yes,
yeah, yeah. I know all about that. And, dude, I know someone who did it. I actually wrote an essay about this in 2003. A girl that I had a super big crush on and kind of sort of dated for a while, and who got into that gutterpunk scene, was homeless for a while because of it and got into some pretty heavy drugs because of it. Got, like, her way of normalizing it was to go, like, hyper Christian, you know, and still maintain the punk subculture thing, but hyper Christian. And you know, I've said that I think a lot of racialism is comes from the same point, except that now that people are so, like, they've gotten the new atheist stuff and the idea, so now all they have to save them is some nebulous notion of race. But I think it's the same thing. And yeah, I've seen it a lot. It's sort of reactive counterculture where you also take yourself to the bottom and you realize how scary it is.
Right. Right, right. You see too much, and then it's I don't know. When I was interviewing Elizabeth Sandifer the other day, she talked about how Nick Land sort of he saw too much of what he calls the outside, and he's like traumatized by it from her perspective. I think that's a lot of what we're dealing with.
I think she's right. I mean, like I say that as a person who went through that, but I went through it and out of it.
Right, right. The only way out is through, as you once told me.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I never became a racialist, and I've never really... But, you know, I actually tried to force myself to convert to, like, Russian Orthodox Christianity. Because I thought it was an answer to a lot of these problems. This was when I was in my mid-20s, and I was flirting with, you know... I consider myself a non-racial paleo-conservative, and... had some libertarianish ideas, and I met, you know, a little bit of haze been made about this, but I met some of the people around who become kind of important figures in the proto alt-right, through this. And, a lot of it was, I think, personality breakdown and hitting a lot of people seeing the bottom. And I've actually critiqued leftist, for not going there enough. Cause a lot of times they don't know. Some people do, and I don't want to say that, like, leftists in general don't, but a lot of leftism comes from a place of concern, but it's distance from the ugliness of it.
Right, right.
And I don't think we can do that. I think you have to look at the ugliness of it straight in the face. And then if you still want to believe in something like a left political project, you should go about it. But you have to know... some of the most brutal, ugly, and horrifying things about poverty, about Russia, you know, about whatever you're dealing with, and you have to go there. And I try, and for me as a person, I guess this is where you're to bring it back around to the first question you asked, that whole therapeutic touch part of it. This is sort of where I can go there and linger there, but it not be dangerous. Is artistically, like, you know, I've also gone into really dangerous real places. You know, I lived in northern Mexico for a while, I've lived in the Middle East. And it's much safer to do it in art.
Well, I mean, you see other, it's not as new as a phenomenon as I may be making out. You know, I'm kind of getting at this idea that there's just been so much cultural change lately that people are going in these crazy extreme directions. But it's sort of always been that way. If you look at like characters like Heusman, who wrote Le Boss, he ended up converting to like Orthodox Christianity, I believe, or Catholicism. Or Dostoevsky. Yeah.
Dostoevsky. Most of the Dadaists, they either became communist or they became religious or they became fascist.
Right.
Like they all and almost all of that came out of trauma, of fin de siècle trauma at first, and then World War I and World War II back to back. So yeah, it's not new. What I think the only part of it that's new is that it's broadcast in real time. You know, in a much more immediate way.
Right. I think Bataille is a good example of that, like World War I era type stuff, because he was sort of dealing with the edge, you know, after World War I and World War II. So it's like, it's just so bizarre how we get, we end up, I don't know how to put it. Like we get like, we're almost like flung into these extreme directions without even realizing it. You know, like it's not really a great way to deal with trauma, is I guess what I'm getting at.
No, it's a terrible way to deal with trauma. But it's also common in certain historical epochs that do tend to happen about every 120 years.
Why do you think that happens, though? Why do you think we're so quick to allow ourselves to get flung into those directions?
Because one thing, I think trauma is hard to deal with and hard to conceptualize. Two, we don't have public rituals for it anymore. And three, technological acceleration makes trying to get grounding. I mean, I know I'm going to sound like a primitivist when I say this. I don't mean this in that way anyway. I'm not romanticizing the pre-technological world. In fact, I don't think there is a pre-technological human world. But the acceleration of the speed of technology makes getting a grounds for this a lot harder. So the instability leads to kind of like, I just want to get off the train. And I think you know, this can be manifested in a lot of ways. In the 80s and 90s, it was manifested in religious apocalyptic culture. And now I think it's manifested in like depressive nihilism amongst kids who don't have a lot of religion, but also don't have a lot of hope. And if you look at the structure of apocalyptics, and this was on purpose, I start with the apocalyptic and move backwards. To the creation, I mean, I literally move backwards to the creation story. If you actually go through the whole book, the last couple of images are about children. There's an inverted Adam and Eve metaphor in the last poem called Grace. And the point. Now, I'm going to say this with the caveat of this book was not originally written with Apocalyptus as its title, so it wasn't the only thing I was concerned with. Apocalyptics was a suggestion from my publisher, but. The apocalypse imagery was inverted here because as a person who lived through that, guess what those apocalypse never did? If they had happened, I wouldn't be here. Neither would you. So like the unveiling sense of the apocalypse actually plays against the end of history sense of the apocalypse. And ultimately I think part of the point of this book is, the world doesn't end, and you can choose not to pick up the pieces and move on, or you can choose to pick up the pieces and move on. But you got to do something. Like even staying still is actually a choice. That's kind of the overarching theme of the book, and that's how I use Pasolini. That's how I use Wittgenstein for that too, and Leopardi comes up for that reason as well. I mean, that's why those philosophers and filmmakers. Showing, but I mean, you know, this makes it sound like it's a super arch high concept book. I mean, I write poems in here about Dario Argento just because I like Dario Argento. And for those of people who aren't into like Italian horror film, I'm just talking about Suspiria and slasher, like what is really weird slasher movies.
Argento is like a hero of mine with his films, so I can relate.
Well, yeah, but you know, JG, you and I are friends because you and I have a very weirdly paralleling sense of taste. You know, and I think it's interesting because you are a true blue millennial, correct?
Yes, 91.
Yeah, and I am what they call a zennial, which means I am almost a Gen Xer, but not really. So it's funny, actually. This is as a side humorous thing. I've actually been published in both explicitly millennial and explicitly Gen X publications for poetry because the dates overlap in the early 80s. Some people in Gen X as late as 84, and some people start millennials as early as 78. So, I've been that weird overlap generation. Also, I remember the Soviet Union, so, but just barely.
Yeah, and that I have no doubt that sort of informs the apocalyptics a little bit, because you were born at the tail end of the Cold War, which was a very sort of apocalyptic type deal.
And that, people forget that, like, my teen years were like, holy shit, there is no more USSR. But that wasn't seen as like apocalyptic in like the same way. But I also, like, my mother was afraid that, like, there's not, you know, not, she wasn't so much scared of commies at all, actually. But she was afraid of like Reagan and Gorbachev accidentally getting into a nuclear war. You know. So yeah, that since in the nuclear Holocaust and that being a real threat, you know, is a vague memory of my early childhood. They also, even though I guess I'm technically a millennial, depending on who you ask, but I'm very close, even if I'm not. That's a completely different background threat. And I do sometimes wonder how much that was informing the weird tenure of like 70s and 80s Christianity, fundamentalist Christianity, which was all Hal Lindsey and the world's going to end and
late great planet Earth. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, the Left Behind novels, which were huge when I was in high school, you know.
Well, it's weird because the 90s, people see it as this like period where, you know, online like counterculture flourished with people like Are You Serious and Disinfo. But at the same time, you know,
that's very late 90s too, though. That's right. Very late 90s, like, but anyway.
Well, what I was gonna say was even when you look at Fukuyama, who I think his book came out in the 90s or maybe the early aughts, the book about the end of history.
Oh, the end of history is the beginning of the 90s, actually. So
okay.
He's really writing about the late 80s, like the Bush senior years. But yeah. Well,
what I was going to say about it is it's odd. It's such an – his thesis is kind of odd because when you read about it, there's this sense of – one of our mutual friends wrote about it recently, that Fukuyama was almost writing about horror at the end of history. That it's this like weird – it's this weird moment where ideology is people think ideology is gone, the war is over, liberalism has won out, blah blah blah.
But he's already seeing some of the problems that
right.
What's interesting, what people ignore about that book, and even he kind of ignores it, is a lot of the problems we have with, I don't know, incels or this, that, and the other. He was seeing as trend lines in Japan in the late 80s, early 90s.
Right. Well, what I was getting at is like in your teen years, you're growing up in a time that's alternately like everyone. There seems to be a lot of optimism, but at the same time, there's the sense that there's nothing left. You know, it's a very weird time period to have grown up in the 90s.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting way to put it. But you're right in that, like, the civil rights movement is not finished, but it's a real thing. And it's interesting, like, in the 90s, because it gives you the sense of triumphalism. And the aughts, too. I mean, like, one thing people forget, maybe they don't forget, but it seems like people have forgotten. In 2001, when I said, you know, I support gay marriage, even the most liberal writer for Slate would have thought I was nuts. And I did, and weirdly, I said that as a conservative, but regardless. But anyway, and it was a platform in 2004 to make sure that to help Bush stay in office, even. And that issue's accelerated so much. Other things haven't. Racial stuff in some ways seems way more tense than it was in the 2000s.
Well, it's unusual because with that sense of triumphalism, there's also this like you said, it's like a hole gets created from that too. Because what do you have to believe in if there's, you know, if you're at the end of history, you know?
Right. And I think what the aughts taught us is the end of history thesis was not entirely wrong, but it also isn't entirely right. But there, one thing I do find interesting, and this is where I'm going to veer into political for a second. How much of our political ideologies and stuff that, like, on the left, right, and whatever are kind of weird rehashes? And actually, maybe the right in some ways is less given to this than the left right now. But where, like, people are going back to, like, 1870 or whatever to try to answer the our 1968 or you just pick a year.
Right, we're mining the past, essentially.
Yeah, where you're mining the past and just let's try to do this thing that obviously didn't work then, but let's do it right this time. Now, in some senses, people are always doing that, but it is interesting to me that that has become a standard left position. And I don't, and by left here, I don't just mean like the Marxist left or whatever, like I normally do. I mean, I also think you see it with regular old liberals and progressives who are like. Like FDR, but for people who aren't just white anymore.
Well, it's like I see a lot of people going back to FDR. I see left liberals, you know, being like, oh, it's like 68 and RFK and Bernie Sanders, you know, is going to be the, you know, king of the world or whatever.
Yeah, well, they apparently, if they want to make that comparison, Bernie Sanders becomes McGovern.
That's what I have been saying, actually.
And then, so that means that, like, Trump is Goldwater if Goldwater had won. And, yeah, you don't want that alternate history, man.
Read, we're going a little bit off topic, but have you ever read Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72?
Yes, I have.
It's kind of interesting because Hunter S. Thompson, his whole thing is that he thinks he can win. And there's this, like, joy that McGovern is on the campaign trail. And then, you know, it gets really dark when that doesn't happen, you know? I think it's the same thing with Sanders. But oddly enough, people are very optimistic about Sanders and the DSA right now.
Well, except for in the DSA itself. But, you know, let us let bygones be bygones in that regard. Because I don't think we know what's going to happen with any of that. But, yeah, it's interesting. And so Apocalyptics is a book of poetry. And would you say this is super accessible poetry? I don't think it is, but I
enjoyed it. So
I don't think you need to be like hyper. I do a lot of poetic tricks and analogous form stuff and whatever, but I don't think you have to be like formally educated in poetry to get it. So, or to get something out of it anyway. So yeah. What did you think? I'm going to flip the cards on you. Haha.
Okay. I mean there was like one more thing I wanted to ask you, but go ahead.
Well let's you ask me that one more thing, then I'll flip the cards on you, because the flip the cards on you is a good way to end.
Okay. The thing I was gonna ask, since the book is all about apocalyptics and we were sort of talking about terror management and this sort of, you know, the weird sort of depressive nihilism. It's very odd to me now how stuff that in the 90s and 2000s that would have never been popular, particularly this stuff with antinatalism, it's now sort of like much more present. Like Ligotti is sort of becoming more well known now. David Benatar has been interviewed by people like Sam Harris. What do you think about this whole, like, that to me is like the most extreme end of nihilism. You know, and it's just weird to see that, like, conjuring up in the culture. I think we can relate that to the Apocalyptics book with this whole sense of apocalypticism in the culture.
I mean, I say this as a teacher who teaches seniors in high school. They make more suicide jokes than I've ever heard. And to the point that, you know, that I sincerely worry about suicidal ideation And I got stats to back myself up on that too. But with Benatar and all that, what's interesting about so many of them, I like Ligotti.
Well, you like Leopardi too, who also gets referenced by a lot of these like antinatalists.
Yeah, I mean, I like Leopardi, but antinatalism to me seems to be, it's nihilism, but it's a weird nihilism that's Kantian.
Yes. Yeah, Benatar particularly.
Benatar takes a Kantian, imperative and then says, and weirdly also a utilitarian imperative. That's both, right? So the two opposed philosophies, and says from either philosophy, it's like no pain is better than pain. Ipso facto, we should not be people. Now, the human voluntary extinction movement was something I was making fun of in like 2001.
I know Les Unite and that whole crew of people, oddly enough.
But I don't think, one, I do. I think when people worry about human population control, I think it regulates itself, honestly.
It seems like that's happening now.
Yeah, I mean, birth rates are dropping everywhere. It's going to be awkward. It may lead to a war-prone period, but like it doesn't seem like just disease drops birth rates. Also, costs will do it. So here's something for homeostatic systems, kind of. That doesn't mean I don't think the planet might still be doomed or whatever. But I think the other thing, though, is the idea – there is this idea that humans are the particular cancer of moral – moral agency. And in a way, you can still end up with like a just universe with that theory.
Right, right. Yeah, it's odd just seeing it become more and more prevalent, though.
Right. No, but I mean, I think it is. I think you're right in noticing it. I think it's more prevalent, but I think it's also prevalent because people want an ethical answer to the problem.
Well, they want an exit.
Yeah. Whereas. From a terror management perspective, there isn't any.
Right, right.
There's no exit. Even death doesn't really – I mean, other than death is – if you believe that death is utterly annihilatory. But even that doesn't fix anything. You're just no longer a problem. You don't have to worry about it. So, in a way, I think the nihilism's not – is too optimistic. And it's not – it comes out of a place of –
Well, Benatar, I wouldn't. I don't know that I'd call Benatar a nihilist, at least not in the moral sense.
No, yeah. Benatar's not. Benatar's a Kantian. But I do think this kind of pop nihilism, and I think the thing
detective
about
stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the stuff about that is one, anxiety and depression has increased dramatically for whatever reason. We don't really understand why. But guess what? Ligotti in particular, and Leopardi also, in a way, speak to this directly. All right? Because they're both...
Could you go into who Leopardi is real quick for our listeners who may
Leopardi
not know?
was an Italian poet and philosopher who's mainly known now. I mean, I actually like his poetry, his Cantis, but he's also known for a book called The Zabone, which is basically just... it's basically just like a thoughts day book. And... he was a very educated, sort of middling, alienated poet who was chronically ill. And also well-read and habitually unable to lie to himself. And there is a nihilism in him, but there's also what people don't get about those books, though, he's also chastising nihilism all the time, you know. And he actually says, like, he's not a nihilist because he's not social enough to really hate people.
Chiron is sort of like that too. I know you know that I'm a big is it Chiron or Ciron?
I don't speak Romanian, so I don't know.
Chiron, a lot. The thing that all these anti-natalists miss with Chiron is that he's making fun of himself too. You know, he's against himself in a lot of ways and against his own nihilism at times.
Yeah, and he's critiquing his own fascism.
Right, right, right. He's almost traumatized by the World War II stuff, it seems like.
Right, and his own position, his own participation in it. I mean, one of the things about the utopias of history, he's not just making fun of leftists, he's also making fun of the fascists, which he was one of.
Right.
So, you know, I think Chiron is a very he's what I don't reference him in this book, but he's one of my favorite authors, partly because he's weirdly honest about his own barbarism and also horrified, not just by everybody else, like most reactionaries. Most reactionaries that I've read are horrified by everybody else. Sharon is also horrified by himself. Like, he's incredibly self-honest. And you get a self-honesty in him that you don't get in a lot of people. And that's what I like about Leopardi, too, is Leopardi is self-critical. And I think, I will say superficially, Ligotti in the same way, although, you know, people like...
Ligotti mocks himself a lot in the Conspiracy Against the Human Race.
Yeah,
I mean, in a lot of ways, yeah.
Ligotti, people miss that part of it's depression and part of it's being self-honest, and also these people are also being funny with themselves, but I don't think when people read them, or I kind of don't think people actually read them. I kind of think they quote mine them.
You're probably right about that. I get that impression.
I mean, to be frank. Because, like, if you actually read The Conspiracy Against the Human Race, yeah, it's depressive, but there's a whole lot in there that doesn't get dealt with. Other than that, time is a flat circle, why do people exist stuff.
Well, Ligotti is weird, too, because people read it as philosophy, but it's actually, in a weird way, its own type of horror fiction. You know, it's almost a narrative of horror through a philosophical, like, discussion or framework.
Yeah, well, I see it as sort of a meta. It is kind of philosophical, but I see it almost as a meta aesthetics. Like, why would you come to this aesthetic concern? What is undergirding it? And Ligotti's interesting in that, weirdly, people, I've noticed this, a lot of the best horror writers are religious. And a lot of them are, like, weirdly pacifistic. Jack Ketchum, for example, who recently...
I met Jack a few times. He was one of the kindest I've met.
Yeah, and everybody says that about him. And I know his political and personal stances were that way. That man wrote the most brutal fiction I've ever read.
Yeah.
And yet, I think it came out of a, like... And his aesthetic concerns were similar to mine in that the horror of violence and human capacity for it. He was willing to go there in his fiction, but he knew what it really could be. And so he was never willing to go there in his life.
Have you ever read his book, Red?
No, I haven't read that one.
Red is about an old man whose dog gets murdered by these teenagers, and all he wants is an apology, and the teenagers won't do it, and the one teenager is tied to, like, a rich businessman, and they basically, things escalate, and it ends in violence, and at the end, everyone's, you know, being very consolatory to the old man after the teenagers and all these other people have died, and he's like, why, don't console me, I never want any of this to happen, it shouldn't have got to that level. And those teenagers shouldn't have died and all this stuff. It's kind of interesting. He does deal with, like, violence in a very honest way without condoning it.
Yeah, I mean, that's – I love his – I mean, his writing's very plain Jane otherwise, but there's an emotional honesty about what violence is. And as a poet, I'll tell you the story. It's related to this. When I gave the first draft of this book, which is a very different book, to my thesis committee in 2006, there's this great poet, Alice Fryman. I think she's 80 now, and she used to work tangentially with my university. And her comment on the second section of the book, which was different than the current one you currently have, actually very different. But her comment was, "You're a very strong poet. You're a very good poet. But you end up in a bloody mess, and I think that's – and I don't know how to feel about it because I think that's part of your point." I was thinking about that too, and I was also thinking, and I still think a lot about how underexplored violence is in poetry. Natural violence, human-on-human violence, and I don't want to say I'm not like Bataille in that I'm not always interested in making the ugly beautiful. Because I actually don't, I don't want to romanticize violence at all. But I do think that if we take the idea that anything, poetry can be about anything, then like, and there's a whole lot of poetry about death in the abstract, then you have to present the violence and death and stuff honestly in the concrete too, and what it does to people.
Well, it's integral, and that's the thing about Ligotti where I see sort of a connection with the things you're writing in a way, because in Conspiracy Against the Human Race, one of the things he offers is that there's almost an escape one can find through immersing themselves in horror. But what he's really talking about in a way is there's a certain aesthetic appeal to self-honesty about things and dealing with things that we may be bothered by, that bloody mess as your professor referred to it as.
Right. And I am fascinated by that. And I actually, I think as a counter to the nihilism, the apocalypticism, I actually do sort of see, well, I'm kind of a fatalist, I'm not going to lie, but
you go backwards. That's telling that you go from the destruction to the creation.
Right. When I also go from the idea that this is a personal philosophy thing, but like you look at the bottom, you look at it honestly, you deal with what it actually is. You do not turn your head away from trauma. All right. But you don't allow yourself to just stay there. Because I think that leads to all this apocalypse stuff that we've been talking about. And I think also it leads to not being able to grow. It leads to, like, victimization. And this is a theme in my life politically and aesthetically. Victimization does not – it is not ennobling. It just isn't. Like, you can do stuff with it. You can use it. You can use it for powerful personal, political, social means if you really want to and try to and cultivate it. But there's nothing innately good about it at all. And most of what it does to people is crippling. And telling people that it's just okay, I think, is usually just wrong. It's not okay. You have to work to create some kind of vision to get beyond it. And that's what I work with in poetry. That's what I work with. And again, to go back to that initial question, like, is this therapeutic? In some ways, I think absolutely not. But in that sense, that I think you have to move on. You have to learn something from it. It is impending on you to do that. I'm going to sound like the Great White Lobster if I'm not careful, but that's something that you have the power to do aesthetically, personally, and even in some ways politically. It's harder politically, but reveling in victimization in and of itself, even though that victimization is real, even though there are systems that have made it worse, that exacerbate it, and it should not be accepted, you know, as a norm for a person to have been victimized for whatever reason. There's nothing inherently good about what it does to a person, like it gives them any wisdom or anything just because it happened. And that's the other thing about, you know, the traumas I deal with is some of the voices in this book, some of the people, the characters that you meet in this book, some of the poetic voices and narrative voices, they aren't able to deal with it. Not everybody. They don't try to, and it doesn't end well for them. Now, it's not obvious. I'm not writing horror fiction where this is usually made much more obvious. I'm writing poetry, so the narrative flow often isn't clear. But I think a lot of my narrators' inability to deal with their own trauma, you know, I don't think it ends well for them ultimately. And I'm totally okay with that being in a poem, but I don't want the whole book to be nothing but that.
Right, right. And I think you do a good job of balancing it.
Cool. So I guess I'm going to just turn this on you at the last bit, because I can do these kinds of things. What were you interested in this book of poetry? Why did you want to have a poet on a cultural podcast that isn't usually focused on things like, I don't know, poetry?
I've always enjoyed your poetry because it doesn't tell you what to think about it. You sort of let the imagery flow over you, and you get what you want out of it. You have to sort of let it sit in your mind rather than just, you know, it's not direct. It's not trying to tell you what to do or how to interpret it. It's open to me, you know. I don't know if that was your intent, but that's one of the things I liked about the book. You can really let it sort of flows over you, and you have to let it sink in and sort of rumble about in your head.
Yeah, it's one of those things. As a poet, I'm almost a little hesitant to say what all I'm doing in a poem, because sometimes I'm actually interested in the other readings of it. I'm not one of those people who thinks that the author has no input into the meaning of a poem, but I do think of reading as a weird sort of mitigated relationship, and it's mitigated by symbolism that changes in time, right? Just to make a basic language point, you know, I have a relationship with Virgil that's very different than, say, a medieval Christian's relationship with Virgil, but I do have a relationship with Virgil. There wasn't a personality created this work, and even though I can't know that personality directly because it's mitigated through language, and language is in some ways inherently dishonest, there is still something there. But my point about that, though, is it's a two-way relationship. It isn't just the reader, and it isn't just the author. In any form of artistic writing that is making the meaning, it is a specific relationship at a specific time of reading too. I mean, even these poems, I think, you know, I wrote them, and when I read them, sometimes they mean different things to me, or I see things that I would like to say I intended, but maybe they were or weren't. It's hard for me to say. And I think the other thing is, never trust a poet who's willing to tell you too much about what their work actually means, because they're probably bullshitting you. Because I doubt they know all of it. There's always stuff going on that's not entirely conscious. And that's true for short story writers too. And my favorite thing is, read what Hemingway and Faulkner, if you want, you know, just two good American examples, what they said about their stories mean, and then like read it over time because they contradict themselves. And sometimes they're clearly lying, and sometimes they're clearly being accidentally honest, and it's hilarious. So, you know, take it all with a grain of salt and actually read the thing and enjoy it for yourself.
Well, I'd really recommend it, because not just because you're a friend, but because I think...
Yeah, we do another podcast together.
Just yeah, alternatives. Everyone should listen to it at Inside Zero Books. But I was going to say, the poetry isn't necessarily the most lucrative thing to get into.
But... I have made $400 off of poetry in almost 20 years. I can tell you exactly how much money I've made off of it. It's kind of hilarious. This book will bring in a couple of thousand, probably not from the book, but because I'm going to there's some readings that I'll get paid for. But other than that, like, so in an entire two decades long career of writing poetry, even with fees for book readings, I probably made what I make in a month of any other job I've done.
And this also ties into your question of why I wanted to have you on, even though it's a culture podcast. The thing is that poetry doesn't get the proper recognition it deserves, in my opinion. I think poetry is very important. I was always annoyed with people in high school who thought poetry wasn't worthwhile, or they just thought it had no cultural merit. I've always felt that poetry had value, and it's always spoken to me, even though I'm not as deep into it as you or some other people I know. It matters, and it gets at a lot of things that prose can't get at, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I think it matters. I think it's something that's interesting, like I do make a lot of how poetry, people like poetry and music are the same thing, or like song lyrics. I'm like, no, they're not. But they come from the same place in a lot. I mean, they have the same origins, really. And I think one of the things about poetry is I think hard, even quote unquote hard poetry like Ezra Pound is not nearly as hard as people think it is, as long as they realize you don't read it like prose. You read it like you'd listen to a song. Like, it's meant to be reread. It's meant to be kind of savored. And it's not necessarily meant for you to understand everything immediately. And good songs work the same way, too. Like, you listen to a good jazz album, right? And you can enjoy that song, like Kinda Blue, it's just kind of normal jazz standard album. And then you really listen to it, and the more you dig, and depending on just you as a person into that kind of music, you can hear all these things that, you know, counter melodies, things that are being really done that are kind of pyrotechnic and with the work and all that in a really good jazz album or a really good rock album. It doesn't have to be jazz or even a really good rap album. Like, I think about a Wu-Tang album or Aesop Rock album where, like, at first, you're just kind of going with the beats, and you like it for that. Then you get into lyrics, and you like it for that. Then you realize that maybe these things are more – there's a history and a lineage and this sub thing going on there. And if people approach poetry like that, like something that you unravel slowly and not something that you, like, consume for immediate didactic, like, I get it, like as kind of a thought puzzle, I think they would enjoy it a lot more. And I honestly think – English teachers have done a whole lot of damage to why poetry is not as enjoyed anymore. More than, like, people sometimes like to bring, oh, the high modernist isn't accessible or whatever. I'm like, yeah, but T.S. Eliot sold a crazy amount of books, like an obscene amount of books for a poet, even at the time, to normal people. So it's not just, he was hard to read. Like, but people liked it. So what's going on there? It couldn't have just been a fad. I mean, maybe it was a little bit, but not totally. So, like, I think we approach this too intellectually. And that's all in the poetry, but you don't start there. You start with the way it feels, and then you get into the rest of it. And if people approached it more like they approach music, I think they would probably enjoy it a lot more.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that poetry will have its day again, or I at least hope for that.
Well, we are living in this weird... I will say, unfortunately, it seems to be having a heyday right now, but it's Tumblr poetry, and it's awful. but I agree with you. I actually think in some ways poetry... weirdly, at the end of the 90s, I think poetry actually in some ways has come back and gone away again and come back again. It's a good literature for reading out loud. It's very conducive to YouTube. You know, spoken word readings are still pretty popular around the country. So I don't think it's gone away. I can still get high school students to write poetry. So, and they enjoy it and get stuff out of it. So I think news of its death has been greatly exaggerated, but I definitely get we're in a time period where, like, people just – it's either treated as a closet art that doesn't need to exist or as something so highfalutin and difficult that no one could ever approach it. And I think both of those are just wrongheaded.
What do you think of the whole outlaw poetry scene, if you know anything about that? It kind of takes a different tack from you, but I've always liked it.
It's okay. I have that anthology, that famous outlaw poetry anthology, or I had it. I think I still have it somewhere. For years, I think I've owned it twice, actually, at least. So I mean, when I say it's okay, I mean, like, I enjoy it. And Unlikely Press, and Unlikely Books, and Unlikely Stories, more come out of that than it does the MFA world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but What's interesting to me is the line between the program, you know, program poetry, the MFA world, and the outlaw poetry, just like the line between, like, normie narrative poetry and avant-garde poetry, that line has gotten thinner and thinner over time, is more my point. Like, I don't think that wall is nearly as much there. Thanks to the interwebs. So maybe that's where I'll end on. People should pick up that anthology. I think it's always stayed in print. The Outlaw Bible to American Poetry, isn't it? Or what's it called?
Maybe it's just called. Yeah, that's the title of it. Yeah.
That, you know, it's very 90s, 80s, and 70s now. I mean, it's kind of dated at this point, but you should pick it up.
Definitely, definitely. Well, thank you for coming on Parallax Views. See Derek Varn.
Thank you, JG. See you later.
And now, two readings by C. Derek Varn from Apocalyptics.
Apocalyptics. Too many lattes for memories to flow easily, but not whiskey to take it straight. Remembering sweat from the swelter as the Twin Towers fell. My girlfriend in Johnstown, but phones nothing but distant static. After everyone stopped crying, two young women kissed on the couch as we watched a movie to avoid the repeat of the news. I once read the way sales can mutate, growing overfunkant and exploding. No Jasper John's canvas blank enough, stark enough for the memory of a woman stripped to bra and panties, crying at a party at the turn of the last millennium. The weight of zeros hitting her core as she partly strip-teased away to the future in a champagne haze. One wants to see too much. I have been to the remains of the cave on Patmos. Nothing but historical markers and rocks. My father, my king, my fear of sex addiction. Like a cicada's carapace, I woke with a lover between me and another man that New Year's Eve. When I return to the place where night stays dark, I see myself emerging with a soft exoskeleton sore from all the changes that I am. This is an ode. Sitting, shooting spitballs near a cloudless sky, hoping the atmospheric clearance slips into God's eye, endless hours spent wondering about an empty sky, I tell myself there's a story. A young man trips into love with an alien. He meets her in a chat room sipping on stale coffee, black without sugar. Later he discovers that she has no form, no body, only light and sound. This complicates things greatly. But as he sleeps, she enters him gently, rocks his chest as he sleeps, inhabits his breath, known and unknown. 10 years later, some police find him, breathing shallow, muttering sweet, sad nothings to himself, bedroom dusted with old skin flakes, cat hair. Then her pushing out, one big stutter, then he stammers for love, not oxygen, as light drips out of his mouth dimly. He lives without her, hacks with his coffin to that sky. This is what love is, you may say. What do you do now? What do you know? It is an afternoon. The sky is clear. The air slicks the chest with the brine of a coming storm.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with C. Derek Varn, and consider buying his book of poetry, Apocalyptics. And also, be sure to subscribe to the Inside Zero Books Network to listen to me and Derek once a month on the Alternatives podcast. Gonna close out the show with another track from Black Sailing entitled Two Nights. Hey, Calico.